And now for a story about salmon and a biologist who loves them. She studied their anatomy, their courtship rituals, even their afterlife as nutrients for trees. Her greatest passion is taking their portraits underwater in the remote rivers of the Pacific Northwest. NPR senior correspondent Ketzel Levine has this profile of the floating photographer.
She's an artist, a fish biologist, a cold water dry suit junkie, but she is no fool. When Mary Edwards heads into the Oregon wilderness for a day alone on the river, she always lets someone know.
Hey, Jeff, Mayor, listen, you're my call out today. You don't hear back from me by 6 o'clock tonight? Yeah, the posse. Okay, bye.
We're eating dust for breakfast as we drive into the Wallowa Mountains, heading for the Lostien River. The two of us are dressed like matching turtles in our waterproof drab greens. Mary Edwards grabs her gear.
Okay.
We waddle through brush and she yells, "Hey, bear! Hey, bear!" I listen to the rhythm but am deaf to the meaning of her words.
Okay, putting the gloves on.
The sun skips along the water as we wade in for the first breathless moment of the day as Mary Edwards lowers her camera into the rushing river and prays its waterproof casing holds.
It's $3,000. And we look good.
No bubbles, no nothing.
No bubbles, no nothing. Oh boy, that water's cold.
Come on, I want to see you get in there already.
Let me get my mask.
Too much prep. Let's go.
We've got a robin's egg blue sky cut by mountains and conifers on this pinch-me-I-must-be-dreaming morning with the proverbial cinematic river running through it, all part of the alchemy now about to take place as a research biologist sheds all professional detachment to lose herself in cold water wonder.
Okay, I'm going in.
Current's pretty swift, but she's holding on to some large stones to keep herself anchored. She's just showed me how big they are. They're pretty tiny.
Little fish. They're Chinook salmon. Big school little fish. I want to see if there's more fish up around the bend.
Mary Edwards lives pretty close to here in Joseph, Oregon, where she works for the Nez Perce Fisheries. But I'm with a very different woman now, an artist who toys with the truth, who will use computer tools to tinker with today's underwater images, often pushing her photos to watercolor-like extremes.
You know, there are some images that I'll look at, and they're beautiful in and of themselves, just as is. And I don't need to add to it. There are other images that are beautiful, and I don't know, it's like I want to change it. Maybe accent a particular energy that's in the image.
And this is the place to be for energy. It's salmon spawn time. Those few magical weeks every year when salmon complete their impossible journey, traveling in this case from an ocean 650 miles east to the very gravel where they were born. And there they nest in what's called a red.
So right on the far bank over there is a red. In fact, there's a fish on. There's a fish on. Oh, wow, that's hot. There's two. Can you see them?
As never before, a pair of courting Chinook salmon.
That's digging. See how it flips on its side and does that motion with the tail? And working up to what I love to call the moment. And that's when she'll actually let her eggs out and he'll express milt at the same time.
She won't be shooting the moment. She'd never risk interfering. And since this could take hours, even days, we leave the couple in peace and head to another promising pool.
Okay, this is great. I just came out of the water to grab the machine because Mary just spied a huge salmon. She really wanted to shoot big salmon today, so this could be it. What do you think?
Well, I don't know sex, but it was a Chinook salmon.
How big?
Large.
3 feet long and about 4 years old.
He's starting to look a little beat up. He's probably fighting with other males. Towards the end of spawn, they look terrible.
Left holding the microphone as she descends once more, I take a deep breath and a long view of the wilderness around us. And then it comes to me, unbidden, but clear as a bell. Hey, bear! Hey, bear! We are in bear country during happy hour. Is this worth it? Mary resurfaces, and I've got my answer. Passion, risk, reward.
So because his head is tucked up under the log, and I can't get a full frame, but what's nice about this is that his tail was dancing out into the light. So it'll be more kind of an abstract shot. We'll see how it looks when we pull it up at home.
Later, at home, Mary Edwards will subtly manipulate the image of liquid light streaming through this Chinook's ragged tail. She'll tweak the exposure, play with the black, punch minute details. A workmanlike process that belies her own awe during a day on the river, watching the beat-up bodies of near-death salmon come home to spawn.
All my science background says, well, it's governed by all these other things, but if I could take one-tenth of that determination and apply it to my life, what would I accomplish? What would all of us accomplish?
Ketzel Levine, NPR News.
Hey, Jeffy, it's Mayor. Had a great day on the river, so we're A-OK.
To see images by the floating photographer, and they include a few bears cavorting at happy hour, you can visit npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
Now, a story from the intersection of the boardroom and the barnyard. Businesses are always looking for ways to get better results from their employees. Well, a company in upstate New York is offering a decidedly different take on worker motivation. It's the Horse Institute, and it specializes in what's called equine-assisted learning. The company's founders say working with horses is a great way to learn teamwork, creativity, and communication. NPR's Jim Zaroli paid a visit.
The morning dew hasn't yet burned off the rolling hills of Ankrumdale, New York, but classes are already underway at the Horse Institute. Six women, all employees of the Farm Family Insurance Company, have been brought into a giant indoor arena. Two horses lope around the fence, another rolls around on its back playfully. The women are told they have to make one of the horses jump over a bar, but they can't touch the horse. It's not what you'd call an easy task, and they aren't exactly experienced horsewomen.
Do you guys think we should
stay together?
Join hands and corral the horse. We could do something like that without touching the horse, guiding the horse that way.
Want to scare the horse or not?
The first team walks after the horse, trying to lure it toward the bar.
Come over. Come on.
It doesn't work. Another team lines up poles on the ground, forming a kind of chute to guide the horse. This gets the horse up to the bar, but he just won't jump. It's too high. Then one of the women asks, why not just lower the bar? There's no rule against it. And the horse quickly steps over it. The exercise is aimed at getting people to think about how they solve problems and not assume there's a right or wrong way to tackle a task. It's a lesson with a lot of application in the workplace, says Marie-Claude Stockel. She and her husband Larry are refugees from the corporate world who started the Horse Institute 4 years ago.
I wanted to marry my two passions, which is training people and also working with horses.
The Horse Institute's customers have included a car dealership, hospitals, and schools. They pay at least $7,500 for a one-day session here. That may seem like, well, a dubious use of corporate dollars, but the Stockels insist that horses make excellent teachers. They can help companies assess new hires or decide whether an employee is in the right job. The reason has to do with the way horses interact with humans. Today, the women are told to pick a horse and place a halter on it.
Hello there.
And I do not want to walk around him. I wonder if we should stay on the same side or...
So what do you think about this?
I'm thinking that has to be for the nose, right?
The horses stare at the women blankly, then trot off to the middle of the arena. The women trail after them. Finally, after several tries, they get the halters on.
I knew you were a good boy. It just takes a little longer.
Stockel gathers the women in a circle. She tells them horses respond to cues, spoken or otherwise. They sense if you don't know what you're doing, and they react accordingly.
If you think the horse is going to stay there, it's going to stay there. If you think the horse is going to walk away, it's going to walk away. I mean, it never fails. They mirror you. The horses mirror your intentions, which is fascinating because these horses we observe with every group, they always have a different behavior. They are you at this point.
The horses ran away, Stockel says, because the women hadn't thought through how to handle the task before they started. Later, Jan Monks, the head insurance agent, says the exercise has made her think about the way she manages people, how she has to be clear about what she wants, something she confesses is not always easy to do.
I can't just expect they're going to intuitively know what I'm expecting. I have to make my...
Very clear.
Yeah. So
clear about your intentions.
Yes. Yep. So I did. I mean, it was surprising the things that this whole exercise has made me stop and analyze myself in things that I do in business.
The Horse Institute is one of a handful of companies that use equine-assisted learning in the workplace. These companies say because horses are so good at reflecting human behavior, they can help teach people something about themselves. And that, they say, can be a useful tool for understanding the workplace. Jim Ciroli, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Move over, Hello Kitty and Pokemon. The new pop culture craze from Japan is ball-jointed dolls, BJDs, as they're known to their human friends. In the past year, the number of Asian companies selling the dolls in the U.S. has quadrupled, with tens of millions of dollars in sales. But they're not child's play. As Nancy Mullane reports, the adults who collect these dolls are totally devoted.
The first time you see a ball-jointed doll is blink your eyes shocking. They're hand-sculpted, hand-painted, anatomically correct, and so realistic, they're perfectly human-looking. And the growing number of women who own them get together at conferences to share their love for BJDs.
I've been really excited, you know, just to see other people. So when you go to conventions like this, you get really, really excited. Yeah.
Jude Wolf and her mom, Char Southall, have just driven 2 hours to attend this, their first BJD convention. Now they're in the lobby of San Francisco's Holiday Inn, frantically changing their dolls out of their traveling clothes.
Yeah, I'm actually dressing my doll just so that she's going to look okay when I take her downstairs to meet all the other dolls and when we go around and have a look at the different doll shops and see what they've got to sell so that she can choose some more wigs and some more outfits and just look presentable.
Southall settles on a red and black striped hooded jacket and puts it on Su-Yun, her knee-high BJD.
The lovely thing about these dolls is that they are ball-jointed. They move at the feet, at the knees, at the waist, and then the wig comes off, which I'll...
When she changes her doll's straight black wig to a curly white one, Su-Yun looks completely different. No longer a Cher look-alike, but a teenage Dolly Parton in hot pants.
She looks good in them.
And that's the beauty of owning a BJD. Owners can recreate a perfectly idealized version of themselves over and over again. Jenny O'Brien walks up holding Arabella Twig, one of her 8 BJDs. She says she loves being able to change everything about her dolls, their wigs, hands, feet, bust size, even their eyes.
eyes will bankrupt you. Eyes are anywhere from $30 to $100 for nice eyes.
And having a doll to put the eyes in is even more expensive. People spend hundreds, even thousands of dollars buying just one BJD, sight unseen, off the internet. Yunju Lim is foreign trade manager for Elf Doll, one of the larger manufacturers of BJDs in South Korea.
We are getting more retail in the United States, in Canada, in Germany, and really everywhere.
And everywhere it's an obsession. Jennifer Cohn-Murtha is with the United Federation of Doll Collectors. When she starts talking about her ball-jointed doll, Kimora, it's as if she's talking about a child.
I have one 15-year-old girl who is my love, and I have ordered for her a boyfriend who is a boxer and a physicist who will take good care of her. And I have also ordered her a vampire. I couldn't resist.
At the convention, BJD owners are shelling out hundreds of dollars for mind-blowingly beautiful Armani-esque wool-lined coats, black wraparound pocket dresses, and garnet-embedded jewelry for their dolls. Maggie Wagner is a psychotherapist and says she's crazy about her five BJDs. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
I'm 34 years old, I'm a grown woman, and I play with dolls. And it's okay, like I've owned it, you know, I'm all right with it.
There's another ball-jointed doll convention coming up later this month in Austin, Texas. For NPR News, I'm Nancy Mullane in San Francisco.
And you can find pictures of these hand-painted ball-jointed dolls at our website, npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Possibly the most cherished veterans program in America is the GI Bill. Now the Bush administration has announced plans to turn over parts of it to private industry, and they'll do it just a few months before President Bush leaves office. NPR's Daniel Zordling has this report.
The GI Bill has paid 22 million vets and family members to go to college or other schools since the end of World War II. And government employees have run this program since the end of World War II.
Veterans Administration offices have been set up in every state, and it's here the ex-soldier goes if he wants to continue his education under the GI Bill of Rights. Any kind of education, and in any part of the country.
But now officials of the VA want private industry to replace those government employees. More precisely, officials say they want industry to design a computer system that will replace government employees. Veterans advocates say, on the face of it, they're all for a better computer system. Sounds great. But they say this controversy is about a lot more than software.
The VA has been successful in administering the educational benefits since 1944. The American Legion questions why they feel they are incapable of doing that now.
Peter Gaetan helps run the American Legion. They're traditionally one of the most conservative veterans groups.
Why are they seeking to outsource a program to a private contractor who has no experience or understanding of veterans' educational benefits?
To understand why groups like the American Legion are worried, you need to know how the GI Bill works now. Say you're a vet, you served two tours in Iraq, and you want to go to college.
Welcome to the Department of Veterans Affairs Education Customer Service Office. If you are calling from a touch-tone phone...
And as they'll explain, you have to send in a detailed application, 6 pages of application. Then a government employee, like Sophia Waranovich, will decide if you're eligible for GI benefits and exactly how much money you deserve.
The education benefits are unfortunately not clear-cut and simple.
The VA has 850 employees like Waranovich who work on the GI Bill. She's also a steward for the Government Employees Union, and she says it can take detective work to process a vet's application. Claims examiners might have to call the Pentagon to get more information about where the vet served.
It all depends upon how convoluted each case is. In some instances, they may call the veteran themselves.
And the GI Bill is about to get more convoluted. Congress recently voted to give vets twice as much money as they used to, so they can go to better and more expensive schools. That'll involve more paperwork and regulations. An official at the VA told me that's exactly why they've asked private industry to revamp the system. From now on, a computer will instantly decide which vets are eligible and how much they should get.
Our expectation is that the new IT solution
will be sophisticated enough to eliminate the need for human intervention in most cases.
That's Keith Pettigo. He's an associate deputy undersecretary at the VA. And Pettigo says the new system will be better for everybody, especially vets.
Presently, it takes us about 20 days to process an original claim from a veteran.
That sounds pretty darn good.
But if you ask them if they would rather have it processed in 1 minute, my guess is that most of them would opt for the 1 minute approach.
In fact, the administration said in a recent report that they've saved time and billions of dollars for taxpayers because they've asked corporations to do work like this all across the government. But veterans don't have to look far to find cases where private industry caused a disaster.
It was a huge disaster.
Back in 2003, the VA paid a prominent defense contractor to install another computer system. That one was supposed to track supplies in VA hospitals. Steve Nolgren helped cover the fiasco for the St. Petersburg Times in Florida.
It cost them close to $300 million, and it never worked.
The federal government's own investigations found that the computer system caused so many problems that it threatened patients' health. Surgeons couldn't get the supplies they needed. They had to postpone operations.
At one point, people were actually buying their own surgical gloves just to have them, and morale was just completely shot until finally they dumped it.
The company never paid any fines, and it went on to become a major contractor in Iraq. But leaders at national veterans groups remember that scandal, and they're wondering what might happen to vets who apply for the GI Bill if a private company runs that program. Rick Weidman's one of the directors of Vietnam Veterans of America.
Anything that goes wrong, I'll tell you what will happen, and it's what always happens in these instances, is they'll say, well, it's not our job, it's the VA's. And the VA will say, we can't do anything, it's contracted out, it's the contractor's job. And that is baloney. The problem isn't the troops, the problem is the leadership.
And some veterans advocates want to know, why are VA officials keeping details about this deal secret? They've handpicked only a small number of companies to compete for the contract. And so far, officials won't even reveal the company's names. A congressional committee will ask for answers at a hearing later this week. Daniel Zwerdling, NPR News.
Author Curtis Sittenfeld burst onto the literary scene a few years ago with Prep. Her fictional account of a boarding school in New England became a bestseller. Today, Sittenfeld tells us about three books, all by women, that shaped her own sensibilities as an author. It's for our series, Three Books, where writers pick three books on one theme.
A few years ago, I got myself in a bit of hot water because I wrote a book review in which I implied that not only was the book in question not good because it was chick lit, but that no chick lit was ever good. What I learned is that there's no consensus on what chick lit even is. Is chick lit any book by or about a young woman? Any book by or about any woman? These days, I no longer claim to know what chick lit is or isn't, but I do know that when I read a great, smart book about a young woman making her way in the world, it's a reason to rejoice. The Blindfold by Siri Hustvedt follows Iris, who's a graduate student at Columbia University, getting her PhD in English literature. The book is divided into four long chapters, and in each one, Iris finds herself entangled in a psychologically complicated situation. In the first, she's hired by an eccentric man to tape herself describing objects which once belonged to a dead girl. Iris is supposed to speak only in a whisper, and the girl the things belong to might have been murdered. In another chapter, Iris is hospitalized because she's been having migraines, and she ends up with two older female roommates who have their own bizarre habits. Published in 1992, The Blindfold is a dark, strange book, and something I love about it is that its intelligence is never announced. It's simply implied in every precise observation and sharp insight. In The Lost Father by Mona Simpson, Mayan is a 28-year-old medical student, though her life's obsession isn't medicine. Instead, as the title suggests, it's her father. Born and raised in Egypt, her father left her and her American mother in Wisconsin when Mayan was young, and she hasn't seen him since childhood. He could come back any day, so we had to be ready all the time, Mayan explains. We lived like that, jangled, for years, looking over our shoulders, feeling nervous and watched, expecting. Simpson's sense of detail is dazzling, and she writes in a brilliantly intuitive style that makes you feel as if you are Mayan, searching for your own missing father. What makes the Quality of Life report by Megan Daum, which came out in 2003, one of my all-time favorite books, is how funny it is. Lifestyle reporter Lucinda Trout moves from New York to Prairie City, which is a stand-in for Lincoln, Nebraska. Daum's depiction of a liberal Midwestern town manages to be both mocking and affectionate. Daum, who also writes nonfiction, is one of those writers I'd read on any subject. She's so smart, so hilarious, and so honest about the way people really are, for good and bad. Together, Siri Hustvedt, Mona Simpson, and Megan Daum not only make me grateful as a reader, they also make me proud to be a chick.
Curtis Sittenfeld is the author of Prep. Her latest book is called American Wife. Her fiction picks are The Blindfold by Siri Hustvedt, The Lost Father by Mona Simpson, and The Quality of Life Report by Megan Daum. For more Three Books recommendations, go to our website, npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The surge in Iraq is one of the issues that divided the presidential candidates. When it was proposed, John McCain supported the increase of troops. Barack Obama opposed it. The surge also divided the Bush administration and the military. And that's the focus of Bob Woodward's new book, The War Within, A Secret White House History, 2006 to 2008. It's the fourth of his books investigating what went on behind the scenes in the Bush administration. In the epilogue, Woodward writes that President Bush has seldom leveled with the public about the war to explain what he was doing and what should be expected. In 2006, when the administration was debating the proposed surge, the administration worried too much about how the story of internal debate would play in the midterm elections and not enough about the war itself. Woodward adds, the next president should learn to trust the public with the truth. Bob Woodward, welcome back to Fresh Air. The surge has become such a big issue in the campaign, so let's start there. Saturday night in Albuquerque, John McCain said, "We have succeeded and we are winning in Iraq." And I wonder if all the sources, you know, of all the sources you've talked to for your new book, The War Within, have people talked about winning in Iraq? Did they see us as winning now?
Not exactly. And if you think about this in the five-year perspective, going back to the invasion, we have as many troops there right now as we had 5 years ago. And the war is not over. As we know, Iraq always deals a surprise. No weapons of mass destruction is all the intelligence people thought. The rise of the insurgency, the rise of homegrown al-Qaeda in Iraq, the sectarian violence, which was just totally off the charts in 2006. And a lot of people are worried about what's the fifth surprise. So things are going well. Things are going better. The situation is much more stable, less violent. But General Petraeus is insisting on keeping all of those troops there because he knows how tenuous the situation there, as it always is in Mesopotamia.
You write in your book that President Bush never defined what winning is. And that was a source of frustration to a lot of people working with him.
That's right. And he, when I interviewed him for this book, he a couple of times talked about win, and then he immediately corrected himself to say, we'll succeed. And this is not a conventional war where you stomp out the enemy and there is a signing ceremony on the battleship Missouri. This is an attempt to create the conditions where Iraq can govern itself. And as General Petraeus says, you can't kill your way to victory. And I think that's exactly right. So you have to do something less than win, and it's kind of succeed. And at the end, President Bush said very clearly when I asked, when the next president comes in the Oval Office on January 20th, 2009, what are you going to say? And he finally said, I'm going to say, don't let it fail, which is a much more diminished expectation than all of this hyperbolic rhetoric that we've heard for so many years.
You write that the surge is one of four things that has contributed to the progress that's been made in Iraq. What are the other three?
First, the Anbar Awakening, where the Sunnis came over. This was before the surge. It started. Were disgusted with al-Qaeda and the extreme efforts by al-Qaeda to impose very strict law. And al-Qaeda made a strategic mistake. And so the Sunnis said, this is too extreme. We're going to sign up with the U.S., and tens of thousands of them have. The second is radical Shia leader Muqtada Sadr's stand down in 2006, where he told his militia not to attack U.S. troops. The surge is the third element, but the fourth, of course, is very top secret, and that is a series of operations that have been developed that allow the U.S. forces to locate, target, and kill extremists, al-Qaeda members, and members of the insurgency. On Friday, the White House, in responding to the book for the first time publicly, confirmed that there were, quote, newly developed techniques and operations which helped the situation stabilize in Iraq.
At the request of the military and the White House, you're not revealing any of the details you found out about what these top secret operations are. What can you tell us?
That it's like any war. There is always something. There's a game changer, a new development. And early 20th century, it was the tank or the airplane. World War II. Manhattan Project and the development of the atomic bomb. These operations and techniques are not something where you're going to see an explosion like an atomic bomb, but they are incredibly effective. They are something that, as President Bush said to people that I quote in the book, we are killing them all. We are killing all of the people who are the leaders. Now, it's not literally all, but they are killing hundreds and hundreds of key people on the other side in this conflict.
You know, in the presidential campaign, John McCain has been saying that it's just really about the surge. The surge is behind the progress we've been making. He was for it, and Obama opposed it. Do you think that that's a fair analysis of what has actually happened that contributed to any progress that's been made in Iraq?
The surge is part of it. There's no question about it, and I say so. At the same time, there are these other elements, and whether one is 20% or 30% or 50%, anyone who knows the facts would agree that you have these at least four factors. To reduce it to it's about the surge is way too simplistic and not the full story. And, of course, as we see in all political campaigns, things get reduced to a sentence or even sometimes a word. And the concept of multiple causes gets lost.
One of the things you report on in your book is that the United States intelligence agencies have been spying on the Iraqi Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki. Why have we been doing that?
Because the situation has been unstable. There was a lot of doubt about Maliki. Very sectarian Shia leader, was doing things that were highly sectarian in the early part of his time as prime minister. And it becomes an obsession. Oh, let's find out what we can about the other side. And so they sit and they say, oh, we know every little utterance and proposed action and idea of the Iraqi prime minister, that somehow spying will tell us what to do. That mindset of let's spy our way to success, let's spy our way to victory, it's just too much of it.
My guest is Bob Woodward. His new book is called The War Within, A Secret White House History, 2006 to 2008. Your book is really focused on dissension within the White House and the military over what to do in Iraq. But it's also a little bit about deception. I mean, you write that President Bush knew that the war was going badly, while at the same time he was telling the American public it was going well, we were winning. How long do you think there was that disconnect between what he knew and what he was telling the American public?
Months. And in a sense, what this book is, it's a portrait of, it's a case study of a commander-in-chief at war, 3.5 years into a war that he started, and it's not going well. He knows it's not going well. His advisors are telling him, the intelligence agencies are telling him, it's getting worse and more violent. And he wonders, well, what do you do? And as he told me at one point, he has this kind of expression, let's cut to the chase. Hadley drove a lot of this, Hadley being Steve Hadley, the National Security Advisor to the president. And you look at the detail and the evolution in this narrative of what's going on in the White House, in the secret meetings and the secret documents, you see that Hadley was driving a lot of this. At key moments, the president was not there at the meetings where they are confronting the reality that they have a strategy that is not working.
So basically you're saying President Bush outsourced the commander-in-chief role in part to his national security advisor.
Outsourced would be too strong a word. Hadley wasn't making the decisions. The president still made the decisions. But, for instance, in July 2006, Hadley and one of his deputies developed a series of questions to ask the Iraq commander, General Casey at this time, and Don Rumsfeld, then Secretary of Defense. And they ask a series, it actually turns out to be 50 questions about what are we doing, what's the strategy, what's going on here. The president is not at that meeting. It would be like in a business, the business is losing money or about to go under, and the board of directors meet and the CEO's not there. These are critical CEO questions, and they, in this case, are turned over to Hadley.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bob Woodward. He's just finished his fourth book about what happened behind the scenes in the Bush White House. This one's called The War Within, and it's largely about the war within the Bush administration about what to do in Iraq. Now, Stephen Hadley, the National Security Advisor, and his deputy, Megan O'Sullivan, started a secret review of Iraq strategy. And this was in 2006. It was before, it was about 3 months before the congressional midterm elections. And the elections had to do with why this review was kept secret. Can you explain the connection between the secrecy and the election?
The elections were coming up. Iraq, this was 2 years ago, was going to be a key issue, and the Republicans held very slim majorities in the House and the Senate, and they said openly to each other, we have to do this under the radar because of the hot political season. The president is campaigning, saying the war is going well or progress is being made. He did acknowledge that a lot of it was hard, but he emphatically said a couple of weeks before the election, we are winning, we are winning. When he knew we were not, when he knew he had authorized this secret strategy review, what's interesting, the strategy review was led by Hadley and his deputy, Megan O'Sullivan. There was one person from the State Department, but no one from the military. So here they're meeting, and it's David Satterfield, who is the representative from the State Department, Condi Rice's Iraq coordinator, who says, here we are talking about military strategy, about what we should do and whether we need more troops or whether we need to get out. And no one here knows the details of this. There's no representative from the Joint Chiefs. There's no representative from the civilian side of the Defense Department. As soon as the election is over and Rumsfeld is removed, then they conduct a second strategy review that does clearly include the military and the intelligence agencies.
Why wasn't the military included, or why wasn't the intelligence agencies included the first time around?
Because then it might get out that
so
they
just
were
part of
questioning. Yes.
Are there examples where you feel that politics was driving policy in Iraq?
I think that's the case. I don't think it was the politics. And it, as I say in the book, I never really, in all of this work and this book and the earlier ones, questioned Bush's sincerity. He wanted to win. He wanted to do it. He believes that it is the right thing. The problem is, what should be your expectations of a commander-in-chief? Truly a sacred constitutional duty. The Constitution says the president is the commander-in-chief. He's at war. He is sending over 100,000 U.S. troops over there for years. The level of engagement you would expect would be total and absolute. And too much of this goes along. And I asked the president, I said, did you give Hadley a deadline? And he said, I don't think I did. This is nothing you hurry. And my question is, how can you not hurry when you have a failing strategy in a war that's been going on for 3.5 years?
There are so many conflicting ideas between 2006 and 2007 about where the United States should be heading in Iraq, conflicting between, you know, the State Department, the Defense Department, the military, the National Security Council. You write that Rumsfeld, as he was advocating a plan to accelerate departure from Iraq, you know, the National Security Council team, their plan is advocating investing more troops in Iraq, the surge. So can you talk a little bit about that conflict between what Rumsfeld wanted and what the this like secret National Security Council team was putting together?
What Rumsfeld wanted to do, and he expressed it in these terms repeatedly, and he did in some interviews I did for State of Denial in July of 2006, he said, we have to get our hand off the back of the Iraqi bicycle seat. We have to let them go solo and do this on their own. And so the whole plan, the whole concept was train the Iraqis, try to stabilize and mature the government, and then we start withdrawing. We have to turn it over to them. He felt very strongly that was the right strategy, as did General Casey. The problem is this is not working. It's not as if it's just a little malfunction. It is that the attack levels reached the point where there were about 6 to 8 attacks in Iraq an hour. I mean, that is a level of violence which we can't imagine in this country. It was, and the president told me, he said, 50 bodies showing up here, 25 people having their throats slit. It was a calamity. And the process of acknowledging the calamity and developing an alternative took so long while the war was going on and while people were dying, Iraqis and Americans.
So as Rumsfeld is suggesting, what we have to do is turn things over to the Iraqis, train them, let them handle it. Condoleezza Rice, you say, you know, in the State Department is thinking this is Rumsfeld's way of trying to shift the blame and shift the problems onto the State Department instead of his Defense Department.
Yes, and the State Department position, Rice's two key deputies on this developed a secret paper saying we need to stand back. There's been too much emphasis on Iraq. It's kind of a vague notion, but it coincided somewhat with the idea of we need to make less of an investment in Iraq. And Secretary of State Rice opposed the surge for a long time. She kept telling the president, I recount in these meetings, where she said, well, tell me what they're going to do that's different. And quite frankly, they had no answer to her question, even at the time they announced the surge. It was General Petraeus who came up with the theory and the idea, we're going to use these extra troops to protect the Iraqi population, give them enhanced and necessary security. But Rice pressed and pressed, and there are scenes in the book where you see her not stopping, and finally the president said, your option is an option for failure. And she came right back at him and said, well, suppose we surge for failure. How do we know this is going to work? She eventually became convinced that after some meetings with the foreign ministers in the region of countries like Saudi Arabia and Egypt and so forth, that these foreign ministers and governments felt we were heading out. We were going to abandon them in the Middle East. And she felt that it was necessary to make a recommitment, and so she finally supported the surge.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Bob Woodward. His new book, The War Within, is about the divisions within the Bush administration and the military over the surge of troops in Iraq. The book covers the years 2006 to 2008. Woodward writes that President Bush turned over a lot of his war-related responsibilities to his national security advisor, Stephen Hadley. When Hadley was trying to enlist people to publicly support the surge, one of the first people he approached was John McCain. I asked Woodward, why Senator McCain?
McCain, going back to 2003, as you may recall, publicly was advocating more troops. He said there were not enough troops, and it is one of the things McCain was hammering on for years. He made regular trips to Iraq, talked to the military leaders in Iraq, and reached this conclusion. And Hadley, in talking with McCain, essentially said, John, look, if you don't go along with the surge and addition of five brigades, 30,000 more troops, no one will. And finally, McCain signed on. A couple of points, it looked like McCain was going to insist that they send more additional troops.
You say that McCain didn't mention his private fear that the U.S. was on the brink of losing the war.
Yes, he met privately in May 2007 with Condi Rice, and he just visited Iraq. And this is before the secret operations or the surge really got going. And he said to her, very direct terms, we are about to lose the second war in my lifetime. The first, of course, being Vietnam, when he had served and when he was a prisoner. And he was quite upset that the State Department was not making a significant enough contribution to the war. Civilian, these provincial reconstruction teams that work in Iraq. And then when they talked in public, he, of course, said none of this. May 2007 was a real low point in all of this. The surge forces were getting there. The secret operations were just getting underway. Violence was getting worse. There was no sense of stability. And I recount these meetings that Hadley in the White House had with Iraqi officials, including his counterpart, the National Security Advisor to Maliki, and Hadley and his deputy were saying, we need some drama. We need something dramatic. They realized that it was probably one of the grimmest times in the war. And of course, 4 months later, when the secret operations got going, the surge got going, more people signed up in the Anbar Awakening, and Muqtada asked his militia to, or ordered them not to go after American soldiers, there was this sudden drop in violence. If you look at the charts, it's just like a ski slope down.
Now, the Iraqi prime minister Nouri al-Maliki didn't like the idea of the surge. How did the U.S. get Maliki to agree to it?
The president met with Maliki in private and said, I'm prepared to commit tens of thousands of more troops. This is before the president really had talked to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the top military people, about this. And then he kept talking to Maliki and saying that, you know, we have you, in very stark terms, he told the prime minister, you are losing control of your country. You have lost control of Baghdad. And laid this out as an option, and finally Maliki went along.
After President Bush decided the strategy in Iraq was failing, he decided to ask for Donald Rumsfeld's resignation. But the resignation wasn't announced until the day after Election Day in 2006. Can you tell us why that was the timing of the announcement of Rumsfeld's resignation?
The decision was don't do it before. Of course, a lot of Republicans who were quite critical of Rumsfeld felt it should have been done before. And if it was, Republicans would have retained control of the House and Senate. That's if history. What is clear is that President Bush did not consult Dick Cheney, the vice president, about this. Now, Cheney was Rumsfeld's patron. It was Cheney's idea that they make Rumsfeld Secretary of Defense. And a couple of days before the announcement that Rumsfeld was being replaced, the president called Cheney in after a meeting alone and said, I've decided to replace Rumsfeld. Cheney was surprised and said, with whom? And the president said, Bob Gates, who'd been the CIA director in his father's presidency for a while. And Cheney directly said, well, I disagree, but obviously it's your call. So this was something in this intrigue in the White House and the Bush administration, the process of deciding on who to replace Rumsfeld with and to replace Rumsfeld, which was a giant decision, Cheney was not involved in.
After David Petraeus was appointed to command the troops in Iraq and the surge policy was put into effect and the counterinsurgency policy that Petraeus oversaw, you say there was a big food fight between Petraeus and Admiral Fallon, who was the head of CENTCOM at the time, the Central Command, which oversees that region of the world. What was the fight about?
Fascinating story. Admiral Fallon believed that there were actually too many troops in Iraq. And when Petraeus would ask for small numbers or large numbers, there's lots of flexibility. The commander on the ground can ask, I need 10 more people here, or I need another half of a battalion for some special operation. He felt that there was too much of this and that they were not controlling the use of personnel. And so they had some real disagreements, which I outline in the book. And this led to, finally, not quite 10 months after Petraeus took over and Gates is in as Secretary of Defense, where there was such a feeling that maybe Petraeus is not getting the support he needs, that President Bush sends a back-channel message to Petraeus saying, you will get what you need. If there's any way to give it to you, we will. And I asked President Bush about this. Why, you know, through these back channels? Hadley, the National Security Advisor, didn't know the president was doing it. Secretary of Defense Gates didn't know he was doing it. The president said, I wanted to make sure that Dave, meaning General Petraeus, knew that I, the president as commander-in-chief, supported him totally. And so Admiral Fallon was kind of sidelined on this. He called it a jumper cable between Washington and Petraeus, and he knew, even though he was in the chain of command and Petraeus's superior, that this jumper cable was in place and really the important channel of communication.
General Petraeus is about to assume command of CENTCOM, the position that Admiral Fallon has been holding. And some people see this as a way of continuing the strategy in Iraq even after President Bush leaves office. But I think other people think that when General Petraeus heads CENTCOM and his responsibilities are broader than just Iraq, that he might have a different point of view about how much, in terms of American resources, we should be putting in Iraq and how much we should be devoting to, say, Afghanistan or Pakistan. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, we'll see. It's a good question because Petraeus will then be in the chain of command, as you say, overseeing both the Iraq war and the Afghanistan war. And things are better in Iraq. Things are not better in Afghanistan. So he may shift his point of view. Petraeus is somebody who succeeded up to this point. As I've said, he's been very cautious about looking at all of this. This is a war in Iraq that is not over. He would not be keeping 140,000 troops there. This is a massive land army that we have in Iraq, unless he felt that there was something fragile, something that could occur that could be a significant setback. So we're in a strange position. He's in a position where it's all going to be on his head in many ways, both Iraq and Afghanistan. But he is sufficiently popular and credible with the public and the Congress and the current administration. And certainly John McCain is, when McCain was asked in one of these interviews, who do you consult? Who are the three most important people you consult? The first that McCain mentioned was General Petraeus. So he has he's in a powerful position, in a very unusual one.
You've been interviewing President Bush for your books for years now. Your first book was about the Bush White House after September 11th. I mean, your first book about the Bush administration. How has President Bush's tone changed in your interviews with him over the years?
In the early interviews and the speeches after 9/11, there was this resolution: we are determined, we will not give up. A certainty. He has retained that certainty about the Iraq war in many ways, but you see it's worn him down, that he is not the goals he set for himself, which he told me about in 2001. We're going to end terrorism. We're going to unify the country. Those things plainly have not happened. And it's not surprising that it has taken a toll. It has taken a toll. And there is a kind of, whenever he mentions winning, he immediately corrects himself to say succeeding. That the high expectations that we were going to export a kind of Western democracy to the Middle East, the bar has been lowered on that significantly. At the same time, things are better in Iraq now than they have been in years, and there's grounds for some optimism. But anyone who knows that area of the world and has dealt with the surprises and the nature of the country and the deep embedded hostility between the Shia and the Sunnis knows that anything can happen almost at any time.
You asked President Bush about how the military decided to go along with the troop surge after being reluctant to do it. And President Bush said, okay, I don't know this. I'm not in those meetings. You'll be happy to hear because I got other things to do. Were you surprised to hear him say that?
Yes, I was. And there is a kind of ambivalence that he reflects that I found more than surprising. He says he's working on this all of the time. And then He makes it very clear, like on the issue of how many brigades to send in the surge, which whether it's going to be 2 or 5 is a big deal. And Hadley says, well, the discussion and the kind of landing on 5 brigades comes out of Hadley's discussions with General Pace, who was then chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And President's listening to this as I'm interviewing him in the Oval Office, and he says, well, I don't know that. I'm not in those meetings, you'll be glad to hear. And as I say in the book, there were points where Hadley was acting as a kind of de facto Secretary of Defense, and as the president says, Hadley was driving lots of this. For the president to not be in that meeting, it is very surprising.
You've been immersed in the secret history of the Bush administration for years now. What are some of the things that you're finding frustrating listening to the presidential campaigns and how they're addressing the war?
Well, in a sense, they aren't addressing it that much because it's complex. But it there has to be an acknowledgement of the immense responsibility that is coming down on the next commander in chief, and that it's something I hope. And that there's been a tradition of this that they will both be given intelligence briefings and updates by the Bush administration. So when one of them becomes president, they will have at least some knowledge about it. But the next stage of this war is not going to be resolved by party doctrine, either Republican or Democrat. It's not going to be resolved with slogans or simple ideas. It is going to be resolved by somebody being the CEO, the commander-in-chief, who takes charge and figures out where we go and how this gets resolved. And no one can see the future. So much of the news is good, but the people who know the most have the most hesitancy about defining that next stage. So it's going to be on the next president's head, and it is a giant, big deal. And it's not something that can be put off. It's going to be on the desk immediately when the new commander-in-chief takes office.
I think there's a sense in the country now that, you know, President Bush is largely an unpopular president now. And in some ways, it's like the conversation has moved on. It's about, you know, Obama and McCain now and who's going to win. And I think, you know, a lot of people aren't thinking that much about President Bush. They're thinking about the presidential campaign. You have found so many problems within the Bush administration and a fair amount of deception in terms of what he knew and what he told the American public. And I guess I'm wondering if you think there's a level of accountability that we have to reckon with. Like, how do you hold a president accountable for not only policy that has gone wrong, but for having deceived the American public about how the war was going?
All of this is done in the tradition of, I guess, would be called accountability reporting. You try to find out as much as you can, and you tell people what really happened, what was said, what this document was, what that intelligence report was. And the accountability comes in elections for a president who is leaving office. The accountability comes in history.
Well, Bob Woodward, thank you so much for talking with us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Terry.
Bob Woodward's new book is called The War Within, A Secret White House History, 2006 to 2008.